versus Reed.
May it please the court. I'm Matt Cavender representing Lauren Reed. The merits of Mr. Reed's appeal are the same as Willie Hayden's appeal, so I'd like to focus on the primary difference between the two cases, which is the appeal waiver and Mr. Reed's plea agreement. The government focuses on the exceptions to the plea to the appeal waiver, but that skips the first part of the analysis, which is whether the waiver itself applies in the first place, and we submit it does not. As the Fourth Circuit in Singletary and the Seventh Circuit in Harris have concluded, an appeal waiver does not bar a Rodriguez.
Are those cases, though, variance cases? In other words, the argument, and we know this because we just had an argument that anyone can listen to right before this, where we discussed the nature of the claim that is being brought by you on appeal. As I understand, the nature of the claim that's being brought by you on appeal is a due process claim. At my sentencing, I was not given notice of the conditions in which were imposed, and I did not have the opportunity to object to them. It seems to me that Harris and Singletary are dealing with a different issue, and that is a true variance. In other words, I know what was imposed at my sentencing, and what ended up in the written judgment was different than what was imposed there. And so all I'm seeking is my actual sentence that was imposed. I'm not challenging my sentence. Whereas you seem to be challenging the conditions that were actually imposed. Does that not take these cases outside of Harris and Singletary?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I don't think we're challenging the conditions themselves. We're not saying that this condition doesn't apply under the relevant 3553A.
Well, you're saying that it was imposed in violation of my rights, right?
I mean, your argument is a due process argument again, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Which is different from the point that Judge Luck was raising. I mean, you stood up and said right off the bat in this appeal, this is really the identical appeal to the Hayden appeal, but for the appeal waiver. And so both of these are about due process, right? Whether you had notice and an opportunity to be heard. It seems to me, though, that the appeal waiver says you can't challenge the sentence on any ground, but there are exceptions that we can talk about whether they apply here. But any ground?
I think the question, Your Honor, is so the appeal waiver says that he waives the right to appeal defendant's sentence. So the question is, what is defendant's sentence? Is it what was pronounced sentencing, which we submit, as we just argued previously in the Hayden case, it was a nullity, versus what was in the written judgment?
Right, but you're not seeking what was imposed. You're seeking to... The sentence is the oral and written together. Normally they merge, sometimes they're in conflict, but that is the written judgment and sentence is what you're appealing. You're saying that I'm challenging the conditions that were in there because they weren't in fact ever imposed on me. I'm challenging those. That seems to be different than I want the sentence that you imposed on me, mm-hmm. but what's in the written judgment isn't reflected what was imposed on me. Those seem to be different arguments, right?
Yes, sir, I understand. I think it is different though because we are we're saying that the sentence, the written judgment, the conditions in the written judgment have not actually been imposed, and so and we're not saying on remand that the vast majority of these conditions wouldn't apply again.
But they have been imposed because what goes to the probation office and to the Bureau of Prisons as part of the incarceration sentence is that final judgment. If you don't get it changed, that is the sentence.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you weren't appealing the sentence, you wouldn't be here. You'd just let the written sentence go into effect. So your client is, I mean, it's a clever argument, a little bit circular, but... you do the best you can. I understand that, but it seems to me like we wouldn't otherwise be here if you weren't appealing what's in the final judgment.
I apologize.
We are appealing the written judgment to the extent that the written judgment conflicts with the oral sentence.
Okay, so you're appealing the sentence in the written judgment.
Well, We're seeking, I think it's along the same lines as Singletary and Harris. We're seeking the imposition of...
You're really not, because if we remanded, then all we would have the written judgment say is that you'll be subject to the standard conditions of supervised release, which is exactly what was said in the oral pronouncement. And you wouldn't get what you want. Your argument is this due process argument that they weren't spelled, what those standard conditions weren't spelled out. That's different. That's a different argument than conforming the written judgment to the oral pronouncement. You could conform the written judgment by saying exactly what the district court said.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it would be enough to go back and for the district court to say that it's imposing the standard conditions. I think that wouldn't comply with Rodriguez. It would have to say that it's applying the standard conditions found in the guidelines.
Which is why Rodriguez, though, isn't a variance case. It's a due process case.
Right.
There seems to be another distinguishing factor in Singletary, and I think implicitly in Harris it's less clear, and that is the language of the appeal waiver in those cases is different, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
What was the language of the appeal waiver in Singletary that made it relevant? The court even pointed it out. It dealt with the imposition of the sentence, right? In other words, the very thing that was being argued was part of the language of the appeal waiver, right? Our waiver is very different. Our waiver here is broader and says any ground, right? It doesn't deal with imposition.
Yes, Your Honor. Waives the right to appeal defendant's sentence on
any ground. Right. It doesn't deal with the imposition of the sentence. It deals with the sentence on any ground, challenging the sentence on any ground, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but I would submit that it's the same argument to the extent that we are seeking imposition of this actual sentence. We're saying that what is in the written judgment with the 13 conditions is not his actual sentence. That the sentence can't be both what's pronounced orally and in writing if they conflict. If they conflict, of course, the rule is...
I don't understand what the conflict is. I mean, it seems to me the written judgment is just expounding on what the oral pronouncement was. What's the conflict? What is it that the oral pronouncement imposed that's different? That's as opposed to elaborated, okay? It's that actually is a conflict as opposed to an elaboration.
Well, I think the conflict is by saying that it's imposing the conditions adopted by the court in the Middle District. It suggests that something has been adopted, but of course we know that nothing has. So I think that's a meaningful distinction.
Let me ask you this. You referred in the Hayden case to the number of cases that involve this similar issue. How many of those involve the appeal waiver issue?
I'm not sure, honestly, offhand, Your Honor.
Well, the Fifth Circuit came out with an appeal waiver decision that goes against you, right?
Is it the Higgins case, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's distinguishable because there the Fifth Circuit said that both the oral judgment or the oral pronouncement and the written judgment are considered the sentence. And I think that conflicts with the law that this court has made clear that...
But your argument doesn't depend on which is the sentence. Your argument doesn't depend on whether it's the oral pronouncement or the written judgment that's the sentence, because your argument is a due process argument about sufficiency of the oral pronouncement. So regardless of the form of the sentence, whatever the sentence takes, whether it's the written judgment or the oral pronouncement itself, your objection is a different one. It's about the sufficiency of the oral pronouncement, a due process argument.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's accurate. One thing I would also
point out. So if your argument doesn't depend on that, then it seems like the Fifth Circuit decision, in fact, does go against you.
I certainly can't say that the Fifth Circuit decision is in our favor. It does go against us.
Fair enough.
But I think it also goes against the Seventh Circuit in Harris and the Fourth in Singletary, and the Seventh Circuit made that clear. They discussed Higgins and distinguished it on that basis. And one final point I would make about Higgins, Your Honor, in that case, the distinction was minor. There was not a real conflict. It was he simply had to contribute to the costs of drug testing and inform others of a search, but those substantive conditions were still in place.
Okay. I think we understand. Let's hear from Ms. Capusta again.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Julie Capusta for the United States. We ask that you dismiss Reed's appeal as barred by a sentence appeal waiver. And as this Court's recognized, there's really two claims at issue here. The focus of Reed's brief, the vast majority of his claim, is a challenge to the manner in which his sentence was imposed. He's arguing that the Court's oral pronouncement was inadequate to give him notice of the standard conditions, and that absolutely falls within the scope of the appellate waiver. It's similar to a reasonableness challenge where a defendant is arguing, well, you didn't consider this sentencing factor, or you consider an improper factor. That's a challenge to the manner in which the sentence was imposed, and it falls within the scope of the sentence appeal waiver. He also does argue in his brief that the written judgment conflicts with the oral pronouncement, and we agree with the Fifth Circuit that it's still an appeal of a sentence. Unless or until Reed successfully challenges his sentence on appeal, he is serving the sentence that is set forth in his written judgment. And if he were released from prison today and started serving his term of supervised release, the standard conditions would apply to him. An appeal of those standard conditions that are set forth in the written judgment is an appeal of his sentence.
But if there was a true variance, I can see the argument that I'm not challenging the sentence that had been imposed to me, which is the oral, because the oral weighs over the written. I actually want my sentence, so I'm not challenging anything to do with my sentence. That there's some logical appeal to that argument. I'm just not sure that's the argument he's making, right?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. I agree that that's not the argument he's making, and I can see why there would be concern in those cases. I know that we pretty much never enforce the waiver in a case of true conflict. And in fact, just a month ago, I worked on a case against Mr. Cavender, and we had a sentence appeal waiver, and it was special conditions of supervised release, and there was an added condition in the written judgment that was not pronounced at sentencing. And despite the fact that we had an appellate waiver, I agreed to his motion for summary reversal. I agreed not to object to it or to enforce the waiver.
That's obviously good policy to do, but I also think it's possible that the argument, as reflected in Harris and Singletary, is that the appeal waiver, at least as written, may not even apply in that case. I think that there's an argument to be made that where I seek to impose my sentence that I'm actually given, I'm not challenging that sentence on any ground. But I guess what I'm want to focus on is what does distinguish that situation from this situation?
The sentence was actually pronounced, but I agree that at least Singletary, the language of that waiver is very different. He agreed not to challenge a sentence imposed, and his argument was the sentence was imposed was the one that was orally pronounced. But when it comes to the plain language of
Do we know what the language was in Harris?
No, I do think he agreed not to challenge
Didn't Harris suggest that the language was similar to what it was in Singletary?
So it relied on Tansel, which is also what Singletary relied on. It was an unpublished decision from the Fourth Circuit, and I think Tansel also relied on that language of the sentence imposed. So I'm not sure that Harris really was that deep into the weeds of distinguishing between the language. I think as a policy matter, it didn't want to apply the waiver to this type of conflict. But I do think, like, in cases of true conflict, there are ways where this court could reach it without having to say it doesn't apply. This court does recognize in extreme circumstances due process the need to reach an issue despite the existence of an appeal waiver. But the plain language of this waiver, you're appealing the right to appeal, you're waiving the right to appeal the sentence on any ground. That includes the ground that your written judgment conflicts with the oral pronouncement. It falls within the scope. But again, there are two different claims here. The manner in which the sentence was imposed, we'd ask that you at the very least dismiss his appeal to the extent that that is the claim he's raising on appeal. If it wants to reach on the merits this argument that there's a difference between the written judgment and the oral pronouncement, We'd ask that you affirm that, but it is our position that that is still a challenge to the sentence itself, and it falls within the plain language, the scope of our sentence of appeal waiver.
Do you know the answer to Judge Carnes' question about how many of these 12 cases that are outstanding, or some dozen or so, are appeal waiver cases?
I believe we have at least 5 in our office.
Appeal waiver.
Yes, of the waiver cases. I know that I've handled at least 2 appeal waiver cases, and there's a...
Any thought been given to editing, revising your appeal waiver to say, and we really, really mean it?
No, we have not got that stuff. Again, we believe that it's pretty much as broad as can be when we say you waive the right to appeal your sentence on any ground. And we do believe that the written judgment sets forth the sentence here, and a claim that it conflicts with the oral pronouncement is still a challenge to the sentence itself.
Yeah, I think the only way you could more specifically cover it would be to specifically cover this issue, and you can't have an appeal waiver that lists every possible imaginable issue that can take place in a proceeding, in a guilty plea proceeding, and so forth.
Yes, Your Honor. Again, we do not always enforce our waivers in certain circumstances where there is a true conflict, but there is no conflict here. It was merely ambiguous, and the written judgment clarified.
What percentage, if you know, in the Middle District are on pleas or appeal waiver?
A large percentage.
Large percentage of it. It works for both sides because you don't give something up in return for getting it.
Yes, Your Honor. They get the benefit of, we often recommend guidelines range sentence. They're often it's cases of where there are multiple accounts charged in indictment, and oftentimes we'll dismiss several charges and they agree to plead guilty to only one count. I mean, it differs case to case, but yes, they do get a benefit of the agreement.
And the more, at least in economic terms, the more benefit you get, the more you're willing to give the defendant.
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you sometimes look at cases where appeal waiver has been sent to oral argument and say to yourself, what's the point? If we're going to have an appeal anyway, why are we giving them anything in return for an appeal waiver?
No, Your Honor. I do think, a vast majority of our appeals are handled with these waivers, and they are, to the extent that they're appealed, they're dismissed routinely.
Yeah, without you having to file a brief. You just file a motion to dismiss, and they're overwhelmingly granted.
Yes, Your Honor, they are. There are certain circumstances where there's an argument over whether one falls within an exception or here a scope issue. But they overwhelmingly work.
I've taken the position before, and I reiterate it, that to the extent that we send appeal waivers to oral argument that don't have some really difficult issue in them, we're watering down the efficacy of appeal waivers and harming both sides, not the individual case. The defendant in that case gets what the defendant in that case can manage to get, but it makes the appeal waivers less valuable in the future the more we are given to sending them to oral argument or carrying them with the case, as we call it. But that's for the record, my colleagues, not for you.
Yes, Your Honor, I appreciate that. I do think it's still a very effective tool that both parties use to their benefit. And I agree that the scope, or I believe that the scope of the language that we use in our waiver, it applies to the claim, whether it's a challenge to the manner in which the sentence was imposed or a challenge to the conflict between the judgment and the oral pronouncement. And again, unless Your Honors have any other questions for me, we'd ask that you dismiss Reed's appeal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cavender, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. One thing I would first mention, so the government said that there may be other ways to reach a situation where there's a blatant contradiction between the written judgment and the oral pronouncement, but I'm not sure there is. And my friend, she did concede in another case that we have where there was a clear contradiction. The district court said it was imposing 7 conditions. The written judgment imposed 8. And so she did concede that one, though or motion for summary reversal, but I don't think that we should be required to depend on the government exercising its discretion in that manner.
I know you make, and I know Harris talks about this, this sort of end of the world, Chicken Little kind of argument of like, well, the judge can put whatever they want in the written sentence, and that means that we would have no recourse. That's really not true, is it? So you're telling me there's no, if the, let's say the oral sentence is, I'm sentenced to 36 months in federal prison, and when the judgment comes out, it's 46 months. So there's someone superimposed the four for the three. You're telling me that, and then he goes to BOP, BOP then enforces that. You're telling me there's no mechanism to fix that under the law?
Your Honor, there's a, you could file a Rule 35 motion to correct it.
Okay, so that's one. And you, there's no judge who's not correcting that, right?
I would certainly expect that most judges would.
And here's the thing. If you file that motion and it's denied.
You can appeal that.
You can appeal the denial of the motion. You're not appealing the sentence. You're appealing the denial of the motion. So the sentence appeal waiver is not the issue anymore. But it has to be the kind of error that it is, you know, the clerical or the clear kind of error that's encompassed within the rule, not the due process efficiency argument that you're making.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think...
Well, there's really not a conflict. One's just elaborating, expounding on the other. It's a due process argument. You say, referring to a non-existent list, all the things that we've gone through this morning, but it's a different kind of argument. But it's also an illustration of why when you really do have the conflict, you do have a mechanism to correct it.
Yes, Your Honor, there are alternative mechanisms, but one way to correct it is, or should be, I believe, is through the standard appeal process. And I don't think that Rule 35 is necessarily a substitute for an appeal. It is a different way to go about it. I'm not sure what position the government would take if we had gone, you know, a different route like that, filed a Rule 35 motion. I don't know that a Rule 35 motion would be...
You're concerned because there is a blatant unconstitutional error the district court made in this situation, right?
That's right.
Okay. Right. So what if the government decides to pick someone off the street, charge them with a crime that didn't happen, and did it in an unconstitutional manner? The defendant decides to plead guilty after indictment and waive any appeal because he's given a very favorable sentence. You can't appeal any of that, right?
That's correct.
I'm having trouble understanding how, in that horrible situation that I just described, that we all acknowledge that is all waived, but in the horrible situation that you're referring to, that is not waived. I mean, the whole concept of an appeal waiver is there's unfairness and unconstitutional conduct that is waived inherent in it as part of the bargain, right? Isn't that part of what all this is?
Yes, sir.
I just don't get why it's any different.
Well,
we have held that you can waive, that appeal waivers extend to even blatant errors.
Yes, sir.
They have to for them to be worth anything to the government, because otherwise you'll say there was error, and we waived all our right to appeal except there's error here.
Of course, then the argument would be every error is blatant error, and so I understand why there's not a exception like that. But I would point out, so in the Seventh Circuit case, the Tansel case, that one, there was a 5-year difference between what the judge imposed or made clear it intended to pose at sentencing and what it actually imposed in the written judgment. So I think we want to have a mechanism in place to correct that regardless of the appeal waiver.
Thank okay. Thank you, Mr. Cavender. We understand your case, and y'all are now finished after two cases. Thank you. Parks.